Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley. Caroline's not with us today, but we have a guest that I think most of you will have heard of before in one context or another. His name is Daniel Handler, also known as Lemony Snicket. Lemony Snicket is the author of far too many books, according to his bio, although I'm not sure that's a possibility, including the 4-volume All the Wrong Questions and the 13-volume A Series of Unfortunate Events. His new book, Poison for Breakfast, I believe came out about a couple days before we're recording this, and that is about all the information I have about Daniel. Welcome to Writer's Voices.
Hi there.
So tell me a little bit more about Daniel Handler.
Oh, you know, I'm sorry. I'm completely losing your audio now.
Oh, no. Okay.
Yeah, no, I'm...
Do you have Skype?
I do have a Skype. Yeah, I have Skype and FaceTime and all the usual things.
Okay. What's your Skype address?
That's a great question. Let's find out. It looks like it's Daniel Handler.
Well, that makes sense. Let's see if I can find it.
Okay.
Find you. Okay, hold on.
Oh, sorry. It's Daniel J. Handler.
Okay.
My middle name is James.
I'm not finding it. Oh, Daniel, tell me a little bit more about yourself. Not as Lemony Snicket,
what would you like
but
to know?
Well, where are you from? How did you become a writer? Things like that.
I was born in San Francisco, California, and I live there now. My parents tell a story that when I was very young, someone asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up, and I said I wanted to be an old man who lived at the top of a mountain giving advice. And if that story is true, and I'm not convinced that it is, then that was the only other thing I wanted to be besides a writer. When I was young and first interested in books, I felt so deeply connected to books and the world of literature that I knew I wanted to participate in some way. It felt like a participatory art form to me. And so I always wanted to be a writer, and to my utter stupefaction, that turned out to work out pretty well.
So did did you study writing in college, or did you just dive in head first? Or both?
I studied a little bit in college. I didn't get an MFA or anything like that, but I had a very good fiction writing teacher in college who became a real mentor for me in all kinds of ways. Her name is Kit Reed. We lost her a few years ago, and I miss her a lot. She had a fiction writing class that was less of a traditional class. You just had to turn in 10 pages a week, and then you had a brief appointment with her in her kitchen where she had read your work, and she kind of talked to you about it, and you figured out where to go from there. And I took the last slot, no fool I, the latest in the day, which meant that sometimes I was invited to stay for dinner. And she really became a huge presence in my life. And she was a voracious reader. She was utterly unpretentious about what she read. And so it was a great way to kind of experience literature outside of the ivory tower in which it is often locked, and to think about how sentences go and how words go and how plots go. She was really invaluable to me.
Have you taught writing yourself?
Here and there. I've taught little small seminars here and there. I taught for a semester a long time ago at a college. And I have some close relationships with other writers, and we exchange manuscripts and kind of help each other out. And I mean, I very much love the stuff of writing. So I just was on the phone right before this with a friend of mine, and he was like, "I can't ask you to read another draft. You've read so many drafts of this." And I was like, "But this is my favorite part. I love this part where I'm figuring out where it's going and what it's made of."
Oh, wonderful. Now, Daniel, did you always think that you would, did you always intend to write for kids, or did that happen kind of accidentally?
Did I always what? I'm sorry?
That to write for kids, was it your always your intention to
No, I
write for
never thought I was
kids?
going to write for young people. I just had never occurred to me. And the first novel that I sold, The Basic Eight, takes place at a high school. It took a long time to sell, and kind of in desperation, my agent sent it to a couple of editors for young people literature. And at the time, YA wasn't really something that existed the way we think of it now. And in fact, setting a novel in high school was viewed as kind of unusual and impossible. But so it was not published for young people. But some editors said to me, "You write well about young people. Would you think about writing something for young people?" And I had been working on this strange gothic novel that was just not working. And when I realized that I could instead make the hero a small group of children, suddenly everything fell into place. So it was almost as if my subconscious brain and my everyday life offers were working in conjunction.
And thus was born Lemony Snicket.
Yeah, there he was.
And how did you come up with that name, and why did you write using a pseudonym for all those years?
How did I come up with that name? I was on the phone with a right-wing political group asking them to mail me some materials so I could mock them in my first novel, The Basic Eight. And I was on the phone and I said, "Will you please mail me the materials?" And she said, "Of course, what's your name?" And I thought to myself, "Don't say your real name. What sort of fool would say their real name?" And so then I just blurted out something, which was Lemony Snicket.
And you have no idea
And there was
where
a
that came
pause.
from.
And during the pause, I thought, no one's going to fall for this. And instead, she said, "Is that spelled how it sounds?" And so I said, "Yes." And then I said, "Read it back to me," because I had no idea how it sounded like it was spelled. And it was a name, and this was long before, I mean, I was working on The Basic Eight, but I had no concept that I would write for children or ever use another name other than my own. And it became a name that my friends and I would use to reserve tables at restaurants, or I had business cards made, and I would sometimes give them to people at bars saying that I was Lemony Snicket. It became a kind of strange ghostly presence in the lives of myself and my friends, who were among the most bewildered by what has happened to that name. And then when I started writing about the Baudelaires, it just made sense to me that because the narrator was so mysterious, that I thought it would be fun to publish the books under the name of the narrator rather than under the name of the author. Because the narrator was really interesting, and the author is just a person making stuff up.
So you got stuck with that for a long time, though. So do you ever have any regrets about becoming Lemony Snicket?
Did I ever have any?
Any regrets about it?
No, I can't say that I did. It's been very marvelous and very surprising. I mean, it's been a blessing. The unexpected success of the books has certainly felt like an enormous blessing. But prominence was not really, and visibility were not among my goals in wanting to write. I wanted to participate in literature. And I mean, nobody in their right mind goes into writing because they think it's going to make them some sort of household name. That's one of the short of basket weaving or something like that. There's not really much that will not get you prominence other than writing fiction. And so, it's been a huge blessing in my life. Most of my friends who are writers are in nowhere near the circumstances that I'm lucky enough to be in, and it's a constant reminder of just how strange it is what has happened to me.
So in a way, you ended up with the best of both worlds in that you had tremendous success, but you could also retain some anonymity personally. And it sounds like it's been great fun for you to be Lemony Snicket.
It has. Yeah. It has very much. I mean, there's a lot of work associated with it, but I think you a connection, particularly with younger readers, is pretty amazing. And I think for most writers who are listening, you know that it can be very hard to feel like your work is connecting someplace or to be in touch with the people who are reading it. And so it's pretty amazing to go places, you know, to go to towns where I don't know anybody personally, to go to other countries and have people responding to my work is really amazing.
Poison for Breakfast is your first new book in quite a while. And
it's
a little different. So tell us what inspired it and why you wrote this really amazing little fable.
Well, it came together in a bunch of different ways. One of the ways was that when my son was younger and he was just beginning to choose books for himself, he was very interested in nonfiction, which was pretty hilarious. His mother, my wife, is an illustrator of picture books mostly, and I write the books that I write, and he was choosing like the one thing for his age that was not being covered by his family. And he was really interested in history. He was really interested in reading things that were real. And there's a lot of kind of textbooky nonfiction for young people. You know, there's like the mammals of Northern Africa books, and there's kind of the history of the Vikings, but there's not a lot of nonfiction that is the kind of nonfiction that I think a lot of people, including myself, appreciate most, which is kind of thinking about an idea or presenting a case. And so I was thinking about that, and I was thinking about all of the various philosophical digressions and various Snicket books and All the Wrong Questions and in A Series of Unfortunate Events. And I began to think about a book that would take those questions and put them more into the forefront. And then I had this really strange, sudden window of time. I was supposed to spend a whole summer. I thought I was going to spend a whole summer in Vancouver, where Netflix was filming A Series of Unfortunate Events. And I thought that that would be my entire summer. And then, as often happens with large entertainment companies, they kind of pushed me over here. And so I wasn't doing that. And I suddenly had this free time. And so I'd been thinking about this book. I wasn't sure that it was a book that 100% could exist, but I thought if I worked on it, it might be possible. And so it was to have this window of time where no one knew that I was working on a book, no one expected me to work on a book, and I just got to go to the library every day like a secret. You know, it almost felt like I was having an affair or something. And I snuck to this place and I was doing this thing that no one knew that I was doing. And it was really quite a delicious time to do it. And then towards the end of the summer, I did go to Vancouver where they were filming it, and I had some free time there. And so I went to the Vancouver Library. And there's something for me when I go to a country where I don't live, and I'm using their libraries that feels even more kind of, you feel more like a spy. And yeah, so it was really a marvelous feeling to work on it in that way and to make a book that was made out of kind of digressions and philosophies and inspired by many very serious conversations I've had with young people of my acquaintance who like to think about death and colonization and the power of music and what it means to translate something from one language to another and all these questions that get kind of woven into Poison for Breakfast.
And there's so much. It's a small book. It's 150 pages, something like that.
It's
yeah.
Into your coat. I mean, it's not wintertime yet, but as it gets cold, it should be into your coat.
And but there is a lot in here. So let's just start. Okay, libraries. A library is one of the settings of this book. And obviously, you love libraries.
I do. I've always loved a library. When I was a child, I was taken to a library all the time, regularly, usually by my dad. We would take a walk after dinner to the library when I was young. And I had some very good librarians who were anonymous in terms of I remembering who they are, because they were that kind of librarian who's interested in kind of empowering young people to make their own choices and find their own discoveries. And then to this day, I use libraries a lot, and I really I treasure what they are for the community. To grow up in San Francisco, San Francisco is the first library system in America, anyway, to start employing social workers full time, to understand that the shape of their mission is not only to give books to people, but to serve as kind of a sanctuary for the public.
Wow.
And that's been really powerful. And my wife and I have been proud to sponsor a librarian prize every year given through the American Library Association that honors a librarian who's been through hard times. And then in San Francisco, we've started a library residency. The city has become so expensive for artists. And so writers apply, and a handful of writers get a small office in the San Francisco Public Library that they get to do their work. So libraries have really nurtured me, and I'm trying to nurture libraries right back.
And that kind of leads right into, I was saying, how are libraries changing? Well, you just already told us some of the ways that libraries are changing.
Yeah, I mean, when we started the Librarian Prize, which is the Lemony Snicket Prize for librarians facing adversity, I was unprepared for the kind of adversity that I would see. There was a librarian who was in New Orleans who was bringing books via bicycle to communities that had no access to a library or where the library had been destroyed. There were librarians who literally were keeping patrons safe during violence that was happening in the city. And not only the librarians who have kind of won this prize, but just the librarians that I've met when I go to the American Library Association conference. Every year, you meet librarians who are training in medical, in conflict, in safety, and they're really taking seriously, their unique status in being open to the public. And as so much of American culture goes against the public, as so many necessities are declared amenities and being battled against, librarians really have stepped up to the plate.
The public library is one of our kind of purest forms of socialism in this country, isn't
Yeah,
it?
when you walk into a library, you kind of can't believe that it still
It still exists.
exists. That there's still something like that. Like if you tried to pitch that idea now, it would seem like
Oh, yeah,
madness.
yeah. By the way, do you know
So,
Susan Orlean?
I
You and
do.
she, I believe, she was a guest on my show maybe 10 years ago on Writer's Voices with her Rin Tin Tin book, but she just wrote a new book about libraries not too long ago, I believe.
Yeah, I'm aware of
Yeah,
it.
yeah,
Yeah, I have this it open, but I'm aware
yeah,
of it.
yeah. So, another shout out to another writer on a subject that we both love. I have, did you ever, when I was a kid, we were in a small town, we had a very small library, but we also had a bookmobile that came out from the big city library.
Oh, yes. Well, I grew up in the city, so I didn't have a bookmobile. Not that long ago, a group of enterprising people bought an old bookmobile, and I got to drive it a little bit. They were driving it around, and I got to drive it around San Francisco, which was very nerve-wracking.
Ooh, I bet.
It was old and enormous, and I wasn't used to driving such a thing. No one was killed, but in a near go a couple of times.
The other kind of thing that's kind of cool right now in my small town here in Fairfield, Iowa, is there's all these little free libraries that people put in their front yard and people drop off books and take books. And do you have
Yes,
those in San Francisco too?
we do. There's a lot of them, and I would imagine that they've gotten more use in COVID as our libraries weren't open for so long. But yeah, there's quite a few in my neighborhood. I think
Obviously, some people are very excited about showing off their architectural and construction skills in Maine.
So back to poison for breakfast, which is the
Yes.
subject of our interview today here on Writers' Voices with Daniel Handler. One of the early chapters, you're talking about someone who was writing about India and Hinduism, and I was really fascinated by that and couldn't believe that it was really true. And then I saw in the end notes it really was. So, tell us a little bit about that story.
Well, yeah, I mean, I should say that another thing that is unusual about Poison for Breakfast is, unlike, say, the travails of the Baudelaire orphans or the story of Lemony Snicket's childhood in a seaside town, all of the details in this book are drawn from actual life. And so it was important to me to put notes in the back of the book because many people would think I was making these things up.
Yes.
And one of them is the author F.W. Bain, who wrote more than 100 years ago, but he claimed that all of these novels were translations out of old Sanskrit manuscripts. There's no evidence that that is true, and certainly the plots and the language of his books are more about Western, especially British, kind of fantasies about what they called the Far East. And so it was pretty interesting to me that on one hand, we'll never know for sure. You can't prove that we didn't have old Sanskrit manuscripts that we've lost track of, but it certainly has seemed to be a weird approximation of a culture that he did not have much understanding about. And because it's a lot of the culture involving Indians, in the book, it kind of leads to a discussion about calling people who are indigenous to North America Indians and how that came about. And once again, kind of projecting our own kind of fantasies and goodwill onto a situation that's far more complicated and violent than that. And also about a musician, Korla Pandit, who was dressed in a turban and didn't speak and played the organ. He had a TV show and was on kind of gallivanted around the jazz and I don't know, pop world being an organist. And he was someone that I saw on television when I was very young. That was kind of the end of his career, and he was always very mysterious to me. And of course, when I grew older, I began to think, I don't think that man is from India or anything like that. And he was, in fact, an African American man. Some people are pretty sure he was the first African American man to have a TV show, but he did so while
To be
pretending
Indian.
to be from. And so to try and think about that and unpack that a little bit, which is a complicated conversation, and it seems a very American conversation about the ways in which we are proceeding in this world and stepping on each other's toes and projecting our own sometimes neg very negative images of from one culture to the next. So that was super interesting to me. But yeah, it began with I was reading this old book that I found by F.W. Bain, and the introduction said this is translated from the Sanskrit. And when I was on about two pages in, I thought, that doesn't seem. And I went and looked him up, and sure enough, his whole literary career seems based on this kind of shaky and in many ways offensive fantasy.
And you talk about well, Korla Pandit, and Pandit being an Indian word that was explained to you in this book by F.W. Bain. And the reason
Yeah.
this kind of really struck a chord is because I'm here in Fairfield, Iowa, which, if you don't know, is the kind of the headquarters for the Transcendental Meditation movement of the United
I
States.
do know, actually,
And
yes.
so we had for quite a while a whole pundit community here, where the movement had brought over pundits from India to chant and hopefully make the world a better place from Fairfield, Iowa.
Yeah. I mean, as with, I mean, the message of Corla Pandit, that was not his real name, but that was about bringing a universal understanding of music, that music was a language that everyone could speak, that music was something that kind of went over all cultures. And so to have this very optimistic and open message coming from this kind of iffy, costumed false identity, I think is really interesting to think about, because I also find that, you know, music is something, as with literature, that can overcome the boundaries that we've put between each other, but also, you know, don't dress up in a turban.
Culture. Another favorite part of Poison for Breakfast for me was where you're talking about a word, and I'm trying to remember where, I think it was maybe in the library or somewhere near the library, and you're talking about this wonderful word that you just love, and I knew what that word was going to be. I knew what it was going to be. And I was so happy to be right.
Well, I'm glad. It is a nice feeling to be right. I talk about the feeling of being wrong a little bit, too, which is a feeling that I've come to appreciate that is like a kind of dizzying feeling. And I think it's part of the theme of bewilderment that is central to the book. I think if the book has any kind of big theme, it's the idea that when you're confused, when you don't know what's going on, is actually when you're closest to understanding the world that we're in.
Now, Lemony Snicket gives definitions throughout the book of various words that he's using.
Yes.
Is this something that carries throughout the Lemony Snicket books? Are you the defining of words?
Yeah, it was something, I mean, it was actually a very big part of figuring out who Lemony Snicket was, is when I was first writing the first volume in a series of unfortunate events, I was just a couple of pages into a draft and I used the word rickety and my mind stopped and said, is rickety a word that young people know? Do young people know what that means? And then I began to think about it. I'd had no experience or training. I don't know what kind of training I could get, but I had to literature. And so I was just beginning to think about young people. And then I said, well, maybe I should explain what the word rickety means. And then I thought, but that's so tiresome to stop and explain words all the time. And then I thought, well, not if the narrator can't help himself and not if his definitions are kind of unreliable. And so, yeah, throughout all of the Snicket books, Lemony Snicket stops to define words. He often doesn't stop to define words that maybe he should. And there's often an unreliable definition or an example that will leave you just as confused as ever. And so I think part of what Lemony Snicket does is kind of mock the stern pedagogical voice that's in so much children's literature. So much children's literature wants to teach you about something, you know, and that's the primary focus of it. And children are onto that.
Daniel, what were your favorite books as a child?
Well, one of the books is discussed in Poison for Breakfast. It's called The Headless Cupid. It is by Zilpha Keatley Snyder, a children's author that I just loved when I was young. I had the pleasure of meeting her as I grew older. She's gone now and a little bit less prominent, I would say, in children's literature, which makes me a little sad. But she was kind of the first author whom I really loved. I would bring back one of her books from the library, and the librarian would say, well, let's see what else is by Zilpha Keatley Snyder. And so I read all of them that the library had. The library, you know, loaned me from other branches, other ones. And then I remember when I had finally read all of the books by Zilpha Keatley Snyder, and there wasn't a new one. And I thought, well, I understand, people get busy. So I came back the next week. Still wasn't one. And I've been kind of annoyed of like, oh, you can have a week off. I understand that. But like, now it's been 3 weeks and there's no new book from you. Like, what's your excuse? And of course, karmically, that came right back to me because as I wrote for children, I would always meet them, many people who would say, and when's the next one coming out? And I would be like so exhausted from having just finished my book and from going all over talking about it. And I would think, just give me, I need a little bit of time. I know the right answer is tomorrow, but it's not going to be tomorrow.
What other children's authors inspired you as a child?
Roald Dahl was really big for me because he was so deliciously wicked. I was a big fan of folk and fairy tales because of my Jewish upbringing. Isaac Bashevis Singer was super important to me. And then I discovered the work of Edward Gorey, who is maybe not quite a children's author, writes these very mysterious books that look like picture books. They have huge illustrations, and then usually on the opposite page just a couple of sentences, and the stories are very strange, very dark, and I was very entranced with them because I couldn't get what they were. And that was really interesting to me, and I think that was a big influence on the world of Lemony Snicket, was that just the mystery of the book existing seemed as fascinating to me as the books themselves. And when the first couple volumes in A Series of Unfortunate Events were published, I sent them to Edward Gorey with this note that I worked on very hard because I wanted to compliment him for his work and say how much he meant to me, and also to apologize for how much I'd stolen from him. So I had to work this balance of, you're such a wonderful writer that I decided to take a lot from you. I hope that's okay. And shortly after I sent it to him, he died.
Oh.
So I like to think that I killed him, but I don't know. I don't have any evidence of that. But I imagine he opened them and he said, this is an outrage, and then dropped
it. Or
dead.
It could be he opened it and like, my life is now complete. I can go.
God, I mean,
you know, I had this wonderful influence on this promising young writer. What more could I possibly do?
I mean, I'm often very excited when I open the envelope and I see a book waiting for me that I've ordered or that someone has sent me, but I don't think I've ever felt my life is complete and I no longer need to live.
Well, Daniel, why don't you read a little bit from Poison for Breakfast?
Sure, why not? It is said that there are three rules for writing a book. The first rule is to regularly add the element of surprise. And I have never found this to be a difficult rule to follow, because life has so many surprises that the only real surprise in life is when nothing surprising happens. Perhaps you were surprised to read at the end of the previous chapter that I jumped into the cold and swirling water, which means I managed to follow the first rule of writing a book. But truth be told, I was just as surprised to find myself plunging into the water. It was a sort of decision you make so quickly it does not even feel like you are deciding, just that you have already decided. One moment I was standing on the rock, thinking of how, if I were poisoned, I might not have many more chances to swim here at this particular spot, and the next I was in the water. The second rule is to leave out certain things in the story. This rule is trickier to learn than the first, because while life is full of surprises, you can't leave any part of life out. Everything that happens to you happens to you. Often boring, sometimes exhausting, occasionally thrilling, every moment in life is unskippable. In a book, however, you can skip past any part you do not like, which is why all decent authors try not to have any of these parts in the books they write. But few authors manage it. Nearly every book has at least one part that sits on the page like a wet sock on the ground, with the reader stopping to look at it thinking, what is this doing here? This is why I left out the part where I removed most of my clothes before jumping into the sea, because no sensible reader is interested in things of that nature. If Little Red Riding Hood, the hero of an old folktale, needed to use the bathroom while walking through the forest to see her grandmother, that is her business. Which is why just about all of the books about her leave out that part. If Oedipus, the hero of a famous play, had an itch he couldn't scratch and it really bothered him, that is not something we necessarily want to read about, so it should happen offstage where we don't hear about it. And I can't find a good reason to tell you exactly what I was wearing or if it required unbuckling or unbuttoning or if I folded things neatly or just dropped them in a heap on the rocks by the shore. So I have followed the second rule of writing a book and left it out. Nobody knows what the third rule is.
That's it. And when did you learn those rules?
I figured them out gradually, although Kit Reed, the kind of mentor that I was talking about, she was very good at reminding her students that missing information is often crucial to a story. That, in fact, a story is made of information that you're hungry to get to. And so the more you lay out for the reader, rather than read them along, leave them along, the trickier it is to keep the reader engaged. Mm. But the first rule I think I learned from not that long ago from someone I know who edits a literary magazine, and I went to pick him up once so we could have some lunch, and I saw the pile of manuscripts that he had on his desk that people had sent him. And I said, how do you do that? Where do you even start? And he said, I look for a consistent rate of surprise, which I thought was a good answer.
Yeah.
But I've kept that with me.
Wow. And also in here, isn't there like all books are about, like there's three plots?
Well, it talks about that I was taught once that there's only two stories.
Okay.
One is that someone goes on a journey, and one is that a stranger comes to town. And then when I heard this from a writer who was pontificating when I was a young writer, and one of the other young writers in the room, Ellen Miller, who's no longer with us, and I miss her. She said, those are the same story. If someone goes on a journey, and a stranger comes to town, it's just a matter of perspective. If you're at the destination, then a stranger is coming to town. If you're taking a journey, then you're the stranger coming to town. And I thought that was a great answer. And she said, I think there's only one story, which is that somebody loses something, which I thought was a great answer. I don't know if it's true, but it feels delicious, and I like thinking about it. But this is the sort of thing that, you know, late at night, perhaps with a whiskey in hand, writers tend to turn to these things and try to figure out if there's really like one little thing that corresponds to all pieces of literature. It's probably not true, but it's fun to think about.
It is fun to think about. I know that I've always, when I watch Shakespeare plays, I'm like, the similarities from one play to the next are, it's basically, the comedies are all the same plot. The tragedies are pretty much all the same plot. But they almost always have the same range of characters too. The glory of Shakespeare is all in the language.
Yes, I agree. Although the plots are good too. Just because they're similar doesn't mean they're not interesting.
Well, that's true. That's true.
I would say that a consistent rate of surprise, I mean, it's often not surprising because if you know Shakespeare, so you're not going to be surprised. He can't. That's not his fault. but I think a consistent rate of surprise is pretty good. I mean, I love thinking about Macbeth, for instance, and trying to imagine if you didn't know Macbeth, right, that you're in the Globe Theater, you're standing up, and then witches come on. That's got to mean the world to you. That's got to be so exciting.
That's true. And I actually did see Macbeth in the reproduced Globe Theater in London. And
there
you were.
Because you probably already knew that there were
witches. It is true. But it was still amazing.
Yeah. I mean, one of the few pleasures, if I can use that, of COVID was that my son's school was closed for so long, and one of the things that he was trying to do by himself, without the benefit of a classroom, was read Julius Caesar, and he was having a lot of trouble with it. And so he and I read Julius Caesar together, and then we had so much fun reading it that we just started reading more Shakespeare. And, we read Macbeth. We just had a wonderful, wonderful time. And we moved on to other plays to read them, and it was pretty delicious. And but it started both the complications of the language were fun, but also, yeah, the plots were they were super appealing to him. And I would say also super relevant. I mean, it had been a while since I'd read Julius Caesar or seen it, and the first thing that Caesar does when you see him is humiliate his wife. And it's really powerful. And it's not, I hadn't thought of that as a play that had much feminism going on in it. And certainly particularly in the history plays of Shakespeare, there's so few women that you don't really think that it gets to be much of a woman's story in so many of those plays. But that to demonstrate that Caesar's not a good person, the first thing that he does is give his wife a hard time in front of a bunch of people. It's really powerful. And to watch my son kind of experience that and be like, oh, that is not a good way to go about that.
How old is your
Okay.
son?
Now he's
Oh,
17.
that's a
Yeah.
great, yeah, to that's a great age to really get into Shakespeare, definitely. And one of the things I love about reading Shakespeare, which I don't ever think to do for pleasure, but I used to go to plays a lot back when, we did those things. How many turns of phrase originated in Shakespeare, and you have no idea. It's something that you hear all the time, and you're like, oh, that's where that came from.
Yeah, absolutely. It is, and it's a weird thing when you go and see Shakespeare because his work is full of cliches.
Yes.
But he invented them, so
That is true.
we can get away with that. Yeah.
Now, Lemony Snicket, right, you kind of describe a little bit of his writing process in Poison for Breakfast, which is, always keep a notebook, but it's often not in hand. You write things down everywhere, and you make lists. And is this also Daniel Handler's part of Daniel Handler's writing process?
Yeah, I mean, when I do teach writing, I often quote a writer I admire a lot, Michelle Tee, and she always says, you have to make a mess and then you have to clean up, and that most writers are good at one and not the other. And instinctively, I'm good at cleaning up. I like a big, raggedy first draft, and I like turning it into something that I hope is better. But I've learned to get kind of freer and freer in my messy process. So, yeah, I always have a notebook with me. I write a lot of things down on index cards that I throw into this box I stole from my college library a long time ago. And I have legal pad. I write on legal pads. There's always a legal pad handy in my house. And all these scraps, it just feels like I'm making stock or something. I'm like simmering something that's full of ideas and words for a while before I even know what it is.
And so you still write by hand a lot.
I do. I write by hand more and more, actually. I don't like working on a machine that is also my news source and my mail and my television and all the things that it is. And I write outside the house a lot.
Isn't it amazing how portable pen and paper are?
Not only is it portable, but no one wants to steal them.
And
So,
you don't need Wi-Fi and
yeah, they don't run out of
electricity,
battery.
battery, yeah.
And you actually get more room because if you're at a library or a cafe and you're hunched over a legal pad with some index cards near you, scribbling with a pen, you look like a mad bomber kind of, so people leave you alone. They assume you're writing a horrifying manifesto that will appear on the news later, so they give you a lot of
And
space.
so,
Whereas if you're on a laptop, they assume you're running some evil tech company, and so you don't deserve to have your own room for your macchiato.
and I'm guessing that you love the process of, you've got your draft, and then you're like, you circle this and you do an arrow that actually goes up here, and no, this phrase actually goes down here, and you end up with this piece of paper with all these arrows and circles and crosses, and is that
Yeah,
part of it?
I do definitely. I start putting things in different order and then I number them, and sometimes I lose track of the numbers. So finally, when I type it up, it's often a whole other experience of kind of solving the mystery of my own illegibility. But I like that too, because every so often I think to myself, oh, what is that word I was trying to write? And then I say, why don't you think of the word you want? Because that was you before. You don't have to read what you wrote. You have to put the word there. That's your job.
And then when you have this mess and then you type it in and it becomes mm-hmm. all neat and orderly, is that a very satisfying feeling for you when that happens?
I mean, it's not dissatisfying, but I'm not anywhere near done with it the first time it's typed up. So I know it's a huge mess. And so I don't take that seriously. That's, you know, if that's like being done with chopping the onion and being like, is the soup ready? It's like, no, you chopped the onion. That's what you've done. And so, yeah, my first drafts are raggedy. I do get to, like, my luxury is that I will send a big raggedy first draft to a copy place that will print and bind it for me. So it looks something like this, maybe. And so then I can go through it and take all these notes and kind of carry it with me. That's a nice phase where I'm just going through it and figuring out where all the terrible parts are, which is almost every page. But I can look at a couple of pages on the bus, or like while I'm waiting to get my hair cut, I can like read a little bit and figure and try to see if there's anything wrong with it. So that's kind of fun, is to carry around my own first draft like it's a book I'm reading. But yeah, when it's typed, it's nowhere near done.
Now, are you someone who plots out your books ahead of time?
I do. I like to think, whenever people say outline, honestly, what I think about is that outline of a dead person on the sidewalk in police procedurals. And in some ways, that seems appropriate to me, because when I do an outline, it's like, okay, you know some things, but that's the beginning of the mystery, is the chalk outline of the person. It's not the end of the mystery. So I kind of plot things out, and then I change my mind. And, you know, as with everything, the map is not the territory. So what seems like a perfect plot in your outline turns out to be ridiculous, and so then you have to fix it.
But you generally have something you're writing towards. In the plotter versus pantser dichotomy, it sounds like you're a little more on the plotter side.
Yeah. Well, I'm not in favor of waiting for inspiration. I'm in favor of working. And so if you have an outline, then something is telling you what to do next. And it might not be the right thing to do next, but at least it's something. And I would rather have 5 pages and think, oh, that was the totally wrong direction to go in, and throw everything out but one little metaphor that I think is charming. I would rather do that than sit around and wait for figuring out what the right thing is.
That's actually what you said. You're not a fan of waiting for inspiration. You're in favor of working. That is probably the most important advice I've ever heard for a writer.
I mean, it just depends on what works for you. But I think particularly if you're working on narrative prose, if you're working on a book, and a book is a long thing to work on, you can't be inspired 24/7. It's like any other long project, you know. It's like if you're married to someone for a long time, every moment is not a moment of like romantic ecstasy. That's just not how that works.
And wouldn't it be boring if it were?
Well, it would be excruciating. Yeah. And, you know, when you raise a child, there are many, many wonderful moments, but there are many boring moments and terrible moments. And I think that writing a novel is like that. Hopefully, when you're done, the language and your plot is all kind of unadulterated pleasure, at least for you. But the day-by-day working on it has a lot of rough patches in it. And I guess the other thing is that I've been very lucky in knowing other artists in different genres and just kind of being close to them and seeing them work. So I do some music, and I work with a songwriter who's really one of America's great songwriters, Stephen Merritt. And he and I were working together once on a project, and we worked all day at this stupid diner he liked to meet at, all day. and we got nothing done. Everything was terrible. And at the end, we said, okay, well, tomorrow we'll try this. And then as we were leaving, he said, well, this was a good day. And I was like, what are you talking about? And he was like, no. We got like all the terrible things now. And then we had this little idea for the next day. And it was really illuminating for me. And so now I'll just, I'll write 8 terrible pages in the day and I'll think, yep, that's a good day. 8 terrible pages.
You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Daniel Handler, also known as Lemony Snicket, author of Poison for Breakfast. So, what will fans of A Series of Unfortunate Events find delightful in a Poison for Breakfast, and what might they think, hey, what's he doing this for?
Gosh, I don't know. I mean, you're asking about people who are finding delightful children being thrown down an elevator shaft. So do we really rely on them to know? But I think if you like the way Snicket tells you a story, if you like the ideas that Snicket brings in, then I think that you will find this book enjoyable. It's not in any way a sequel or a continuation of anything in All the Wrong Questions or in A Series of Unfortunate Events, but it takes place within the kind of universe of Lemony Snicket thinking about terrible things. So I think you might enjoy yourself there. I don't know. You should pick it up and see if you like it. That's okay.
And obviously, philosophy is something that you enjoy. And do you feel like that Poison for Breakfast is a way to bring philosophical ideas to some people, to people who might not otherwise be exposed to them?
Well, I don't think it's that they're not exposed to them, right? I don't think anyone's going to pick up my book and say, I was not aware that I was going to die. Oh my God. Terrible news. I think they probably know that. But I think often we're in a space where we're not encouraged to think about those ideas, particularly when you're young. Your whole childhood, you're spacing out, and someone says, like, you got to put your shoes on, or you have like another question. They say, it's time to get out of the car. We don't have time to talk about this. And I think this book encourages the thinking about those things that, particularly in youth, you're often rushed past.
Well, and there are, but you also are in maybe introducing some ideas that people might not have been exposed to, like what exactly is Zim Zoom?
Zimzum, yeah, it's mostly a Jewish idea, although it has echoes in many other cultures. But and you're right, probably not a lot of people have direct exposure to it. But part of Zimzum is basically the idea that to do something, you have to create an empty space for it. So part of doing something is first creating an empty space, and I think that's really something that we feel often in the lexicon, right? Even just the phrase like make a space for something, right? Make a space to do something in your home or make space in your mind to think about this. So this is something that we do, but we often don't have a word for it or we haven't just thought of it for a time. And I thought that was a good, already actually, I heard from someone who said, I read Poison for Breakfast and I felt myself emptying my mind to do something else, and I realized that this is something that I knew now. This is something that I was able to talk to
I
her.
used to always want to keep an empty drawer in my kitchen.
Yeah?
Yeah, just to have room for more of something. Yeah,
Interesting.
yeah,
Okay.
yeah.
Yeah. I don't think my kitchen's big enough to have an
Yeah,
empty
mine
drawer.
isn't anymore either,
I'm thinking of all the drawers and I don't know which one I could empty. But I need those pot holders. I can't.
But no,
It's
I would rather have, actually, I would rather have, if I have four drawers, three of them that are kind of overfull and one empty one, rather than spread everything out among the four. Yeah.
interesting. I don't think I've cracked the code of figuring out how to organize my kitchen. We're always redoing it and it never quite works because we want everything in handy, really.
Yeah, and that's impossible.
It's hard to do.
Especially now that there's so many specialty gadgets, and so it's like all these, instead of one tool that does 10 things, you have 10 tools that do one thing each a lot of times. And so how do you keep them
all? Well, that always feels, that's actually a metaphor I use a lot when I'm when talking about writing, because you think it would get easier the more books you write. But I think every book is exactly like that. It's like a strange cooking implement or a strange ingredient. You know, when you buy an ingredient that you never use again, you know, some recipe. And that's what it feels like. Like, by the time I'm done with a book, I think, oh, now I know how to write that book. It's too bad that I'm never going to write that book again. So I'm completely flopped than any other book. But I have learned this skill that if I could go back in time, would make it easier.
Now, you did talk about being involved somewhat in the filming of the TV series. How involved do you get in, like, the movies and the films that are made from you and the TV shows made from your books?
It really depends. But in the case of the Netflix adaptation, it followed a pretty familiar pattern to me, which is that I was fired a number of times as part of a circle, a circle of, like, get out of here. And then, like, hey, we can't do it without you. Come on back. And then, get out of here. And so that became pretty familiar to me. But I did get to run the writer's room for a couple of seasons in for Netflix. And that was in my own dining room. And I chose the writers who were in that room with me. And we really worked together cohesively and non-competitively. And that was a real learning experience for me. And one of the writers just won an Emmy for something else. They've all moved on in their careers and are all kind of continuing to blossom. And so that was an exciting part for me. But, you know, film and television, things like that, are very collaborative. They're very expensive. So somewhere there's someone worrying about the millions and millions of dollars that they're spending, as anyone would, right?
Yeah, and you have much less control over the end result than you do of your books.
Yeah, I mean, there's no way you could have all the control over it. You know, you can't hole up and sew all the costumes yourself and then set the lights up, you know? And so there's lots and lots of people working on it. But I think the main difference is really money. It's very, very expensive to make that in a way that it's not expensive to make a book, and certainly not expensive to write a book. And so, there's always somebody. I mean, I was on the phone only yesterday with some people from a film company, and, you know, they're nervous because it's millions and millions of dollars. If someone gave you a suitcase with like $55 million in it and they said, we need you to walk across town and make sure this gets across town safely, you would be freaked out the whole time. And that's how they are. They're freaked out. They don't want to lose that money.
Yeah. Yeah. Are you glad that your books are made into movies and TV series?
I think it certainly has made people curious about the books. I think that's happened a lot. And I think particularly in the kind of culture that streaming entertainment has created in the past, whatever it is, decade or so, I've heard from so many families who said, oh, we started watching, you know, we all watched the show together. This is something that we can all watch together. You know, we decide on a rainy night that we're going to watch two episodes, and the next time we watch one episode, you know, and it's like we're all having fun watching this thing together, and that seems like a nice thing to be a part of.
That is true. Well, Daniel, I want to thank you for being with us today, and sorry for the technical difficulties.
It's the first time I've ever heard of technical difficulties.
Oh, I bet. And we always close Writer's Voices with a quote, and I'm going to use one that you quoted in Poison for Breakfast, because I really love this. God made everything out of nothing, but the nothingness shows through.
Mm-hmm.
And that's from Paul Valéry. Is that how you pronounce his name?
Yeah, Paul Valéry. He's a French writer. I have a book of his right on my desk right now, but I don't know why I'm bothering to hold that up in an audio presentation. But yeah, he's a writer I've long admired, and he's a writer who's most famous for never quite having completed any of the things that he wanted to do, which I also don't.
I sounds like me.
Sounds like the thriller, really.
Oh, thank you so much, Daniel.
Thank you so much,
Dr. And see you next week on Writer's Voices.